Coming up next, Upstate's HealthLink on Air. On tonight's program, we talk to two physicians returning from an important medical mission to Ethiopia.
It's a matter of, you know, teaching them, but also providing that equipment and giving them support more than just on one trip, but actually a long-lasting relationship with these doctors.
Plus, a registered nurse making a return trip to Ghana.
And we travel out to the remote villages and set up temporary mobile health clinics. And we provide care to the villagers.
And a new mammography program designed to increase access for women of color in central New York.
There's lots of different barriers to people of color, in particular, and people living in poverty, I think, to seeking health care on a timely basis.
We'll get expert advice on ADHD and hear from our healing muse. That's all coming up right after the news. This is Upstate Medical University's HealthLink on Air, your weekly dose of information about health and medical issues affecting Central New Yorkers from the region's only academic medical center. I'm your host, Linda Cohen. On tonight's show, we explore medical missions, both here at home and abroad. We'll hear about a continuing local medical mission to help the people in Ghana receive the medical treatment and services so sorely needed there. Plus, a local partnership between a healthcare institution and a community can promote a medical mission here at home. But first, we listen again to an earlier interview with two local physicians who bring their expertise to Ethiopia to help the people there. By the way, their story is featured prominently in the winter issue of Upstate Health magazine, which can be found in waiting rooms throughout the Upstate Medical University campus or online at upstate.edu/whatsup. Physicians and healthcare workers on medical missions to third world countries can offer profound assistance to these medically challenged places. We'll hear with more on this are two individuals who recently returned from one such mission, this time to northern Ethiopia. Dr. Rick Kelly and Dr. Sam Woods are ear, nose, and throat surgeons from Upstate Medical University. Welcome to you both. Thanks for coming in.
Oh, my pleasure.
So, Dr. Kelly, this was not your first trip to Ethiopia. Tell us about that.
This is actually the fifth medical trip and 12th trip overall to Ethiopia.
Wow.
This started back in 2009 when my wife and I decided that our house could hold more kids, and we looked into international adoption, chose Ethiopia, and in so doing, in the process of this international adoption, we looked at what the status of healthcare is. I mean, being a doctor, my wife is a speech-language pathologist, and so we wanted to get an idea and found that it's a huge need there, and even more specifically with ENT, there's only 8 ENT doctors for 80 million people. And a previous medical trip, there was a doctor from Stanford where I'd gone to medical school. And so I thought it was kind of a divine thing that perhaps, oh, there's a need for ENT doctors. That's what I do. We're going to Ethiopia. And so it took on a life of its own in terms of looking at medical aspects and trying to help out in that country.
So help us understand, when you went there actually for an adoption, that was the purpose, but when you got there, how did you actually tap into the medical system and the needs that were there?
Well, ENT is a relatively small world, and in contacting beforehand the doctor who had been to Ethiopia once, I found out the name for another ENT doctor there, and our first night in Ethiopia, being jet-lagged and fatigued, we actually got picked up in a car by an ENT doctor. We get driven around at night in this foreign land, foreign city, to a restaurant where they had a camel carcass on the wall and carving off fresh meat.
And it was just Lord, that was really walking through the looking glass, so to speak.
It was life-changing.
Yeah.
And then from that, we just began to develop contacts, and over the years, that's just grown, and what we've been able to try to accomplish and do has grown.
So, Dr. Woods, how did you get involved?
Well, Rick saw that one of the great needs was for training ear surgeons over there, and training specifically dealing with ear-related diseases. And I was trained as a otologist, neuro-otologist, which is really just ear-related surgery. And so he asked me if I'd like to be involved. I had done
So he talked you into it.
He talked me into it. I had done previously some medical mission work in Mexico, and that I was no longer doing. So I've always sort of had that commitment, and so...
So he knew who to tap.
He knew who to tap.
Yeah, that's very interesting. So tell us about what you saw specifically. You've alluded to the fact that there is a need there specifically for ENT. What kinds of things did you see or did you find that needed attention?
Well, on the first trip, I went with a general surgeon. And because there was no ENT doctor, the awareness of ear disease and hearing loss was really under the radar. So at this district hospital down in the south, they made a radio announcement 3 days beforehand. And when I talked to the organizing people there, they said, well, we anticipate maybe like 10 or 15 people would come to see an ENT doctor. We don't really know. And when I got there, there's about 250 people.
Oh, my God.
There was security issues. There was, this great surprise that they had.
Like, announce it and they will come.
And they did come. And people traveled for 2 days to get there. And they came with their families. They were willing to wait as long as it took. And so, struggling through to seeing 200 people, it turned out that about 90% of those people were there for ear disease and hearing loss. And that's where coming into roping, Sam... was invaluable, as well as other people from Central New York. We've had a couple of anesthesiologists, Dr. Wendy Howard and Sarah Stewart, and Dr. Tammy Cordes at SU, and Dr. Karen Doherty there, and Dr. Tucker Harris, another ENT doctor in our department. So I've been pretty good at roping a lot of people from Central New York, and Brian Chinatry from St. Joe's as well.
So you've been engaged then in both evaluation and treatment, as I said. So in the time, first of all, help us understand how many times you've been. You said 12 times, right?
Overall, for five medical trips.
Five medical trips, and how about
And
you?
I've been twice, one to a city called Owasa, which is in the southern part of Ethiopia, and then most recently we went to Mekele, which is in the northern part of Ethiopia. And I guess one of the ways to characterize a very basic ear-related problem there is try to imagine that a huge portion of the population lives very rural. I mean, they don't have cars, they have carts, and they walk everywhere. And these children and young adults are getting ear infections. There are antibiotics available in the country, but they don't have access to go see a doctor to get the antibiotics. So there they are, they get ear infections, they perforate their eardrum, and they basically don't have eardrums on either side. And so a lot of these patients that came to see us basically just didn't have eardrums. And when that happens, you end up with probably about a 45 to 50% hearing loss.
Yeah.
And there's no access to hearing aids. There's no access to batteries. And so they live with that hearing loss that they've had maybe since a child. And so if we did nothing else other than train some of the otolaryngologists there, some of the ENT doctors, to repair eardrums, that would make a huge difference for those people.
And in effect, is that what you were involved with?
Yes.
In doing eardrum repair?
Yes.
Wow. So you literally, you could improve someone's hearing from 40% down to, what, 100%? Or
especially
close to
if
that?
You caught them early enough. If you live with perforations for a long, long time, a lot of that hearing loss is not very reversible. But if you catch those children earlier, it can be.
Yeah, especially with what I know about language development. If it's an early stage of language development, they will lose
That's
something
true.
In the way of their language skills. But if you can repair it at a reasonable age, you can probably regain a lot of those cognitive skills and linguistic skills as
sure.
well. So that's really crucial.
Yeah.
Really
and for crucial the future, work. One of the things that we're going to try to work on is a little bit of that access to antibiotics. How can we get treatment to some of those rural areas?
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with Upstate otolaryngologists Dr. Rick Kelly and Dr. Sam Woods. We're talking about their medical mission to Ethiopia. So it sounds to me like as much as dealing with the acute problems that you found or the chronic problems that you found, you also have a sense of the need to aid in the healthcare delivery system there. And you founded some kind of an organization. Tell us about that.
Yeah, we started an organization called Hearing Loss Prevention in Ethiopia. And there's a website that you can go to hlp-ethiopia.org, and there's a Facebook page where you can go and like us. But it's a, just to give some information and also the ability for people to donate some money to try to help with this process. And I think the what we figured out on that very first trip was that although it may feel good to go on a medical trip and go treat a couple of hundred people, it's really just a drop in the bucket. And the whole idea of, like, you know, you can teach someone how to fish and they'll have fish for life kind of model is what we developed. And so it's going and educating and training them. And beyond that, though, is getting them equipment, because these doctors have nothing. They may finish training as an ENT doctor, and it's just a very recent program, but they'll get out to a hospital. There'll be no otoscope, which is that device on the wall that your doctor will look in your ears. There'll be nothing but a tongue blade. There'll be nothing in the OR for them to do surgery on. And so it's a matter of, you know, teaching them, but also providing that equipment and giving them support more than just on one trip, but actually a long-lasting relationship with these doctors to kind of act as their mentor.
So you're, besides the mentoring, excuse me, your organization is attempting to raise funds to then help them. Is that part of it? Or at least provide them with equipment?
All of that. We actually get donated equipment, but the most of the expense is shipping equipment over there. There's nothing that goes towards administrative costs. The doctors pay their own way to get there. So any donations go specifically to get equipment over there and to help that to be a sustained method.
And once again, how can people find out about this organization?
Well, again, they can go website. Yeah, website hlp-ethiopia.org, and we're actually relaunching a website for Partners for Global Hearing, which will be up in the next month or so. And that was the brainchild of my wife Ashley and our son's help too, in terms of a logo design from my son Devin, who just finished at RIT, and my son Nick, who's up here at SU.
So I also understand you adopted several children from Ethiopia.
Well, our first experience was so great that we went ahead and adopted three more daughters after that. So we now have four, ranging from 10 years old down to three. And they've just been a great addition to our family.
Wow, that's quite remarkable, actually. So, but what I started to hear you say, actually, Dr. Woods, was that antibiotics did exist in the country, but there's something about the healthcare delivery system in terms of access that needs some help. So is that also something, as Dr. Kelly was saying, that you need to really give them, empower them to have this ability in Ethiopia? It's not enough to just come in, you know, on a white horse and then leave.
Well, to go back over again what Rick said, when we first went over there, It's easy for a medical mission to go over and just maybe do 15 to 20 surgical cases, and then you pick up your equipment and leave. And we really felt very, very strongly that our mission would really have to be to train these people. And as we're over there training these people, we're constantly picking their brains as to how can we help you better. And we've just really sort of started this conversation as to how to improve access to antibiotics. Again, the physical ability of antibiotics is there at the major cities. But how do you take that and get it to somebody who maybe lives 25 or 50 miles away? And this child gets an ear infection, and the parents really don't have access to those antibiotics.
So it's a lot also in terms of access, but it's also education, I would think.
It's education and access.
Filtering that down to the level of the you know, the villages and the towns,
right,
and that kind of thing.
Yeah. I mean, we focus on the ENT doctors, but it's much more than that. There's no audiologist there, and we're looking into developing training programs for audiology.
Wow.
We've developed delivered operative microscopes and surgical equipment. So again, once we train them, they can actually do the surgeries. And so I imagine rather than the 20 or 50 surgeries, that there's been hundreds of surgeries that are now done as a result of our efforts there.
In the little bit of time we have left, what would you say to other healthcare providers who might be interested in this kind of thing? What was the greatest, most rewarding thing about this experience? First you, Dr. Kelly.
Well, I would say it kind of reinvigorates why we went into medicine in the first place. And now we deal with EMRs and patient after patient, and it really, you get there and it boils down to you and the patient and your ability to help. Even the smallest little things there, just even providing hope to them is a huge impact.
How about you,
These
Dr.
people
Ruth?
Are so thankful. So that's one of the main reasons. And then the friendships that you develop with these other healthcare workers around the world is quite amazing. And we also bring them over here. We've been able to bring two of the ENT doctors over here through our National Academy. And one of them will actually be here in the fall training with us for a week or two.
Wonderful. Well, I applaud you both. It's an incredible thing that you're doing and really having very significant impact. And as you said, one of the reasons probably you chose medicine to begin with. So I want to thank you. My guests have been Dr. Rick Kelly and Dr. Sam Woods. They're otolaryngologists from Upstate Medical University and telling us about a medical mission to Ethiopia. Coming up next, another medical mission to Africa, this time to Ghana. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. This is Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Linda Cohen along with you. Well, there's been much press of late about the humanitarian and medical missions to West Africa due to the Ebola outbreak. But there continue to be less well-known, homegrown medical humanitarian efforts taking place right here in central New York. And here to tell us about it is Lori Ruprecht. She's a pediatric registered nurse with the Center for Developmental Behavior and Genetics at Upstate Medical University, and Sue Converse. She's a family nurse practitioner from St. Joseph's Hospital, also here in Syracuse. Thank you both for coming in.
Thank
Appreciate
you.
Appreciate your being here. Lori, this is your baby. I know you've been in this on this show before, mm-hmm. telling us about your missions to Ghana.
Right.
So tell us again, you're going again to Ghana now, right?
Or we
coming
are.
Up,
yep.
upcoming. How many times have you been there? First of all,
I've been there. This will be my fifth time.
Wow. And what are you attempting to do? Give us a general overview of some of the concepts or the mission of your work.
Okay. What we do is we travel to Ghana. We travel out to the remote villages and set up temporary mobile health clinics. And we provide care to the villagers.
So your goal is to really spread health care out into the hinterland, so to speak.
Correct. So all the villages we go to are at least 100 miles from the nearest hospital. So if they really don't go for care unless they're really, really sick. So they don't get general checkups.
So is a lot of what you're attempting to do kind of prophylactic, like things
yes.
like immunization, just checking people overall in terms of their growth and development?
Right.
And you do the full range from children all the way to adults?
Correct, yes. And it depends on what volunteers we get, what we provide. Last trip we had a dental hygienist, so we did teeth cleanings. We were able to clean the children's teeth and educate them on how to brush their teeth and why to brush their teeth.
So a lot of kind of overall health measures and
Correct.
General kind of prophylactic kind of
mm-hmm.
health. Now, Sue, you are a volunteer for this program, I understand. Thank
yes.
you for coming in today. How did you get involved?
Actually, I'm a professor at the College of Nursing at St. Joe's, and one of my students said she had heard Lori on, I believe, on this show previously. And said, you know, I heard you say that this is something you want to do in the future, and this is going on. Would you like to be involved? And I did.
So you actually have gone on one of these missions?
I did go last year, yes.
And what was it like for you?
It was truly life-changing. You know, people talk about that, about going on medical missions or just missions in general, and it is truly life-changing. I'm also work at a pediatric clinic and provide care to a fairly poor community, but they're still in this, you know, first world country, a sense of entitlement. And when I was there in Ghana, I really practiced medicine the way I envisioned I would practice it when I started down this road as a nurse. I was able to just go and care for people to the best of my ability. And they were so appreciative. They were very, very appreciative. And they were patient. And
And were they compliant as well? They listened to what you told
them
to do?
They would hung on your every word. And they, you know, there were people that were there waiting for hours and hours, and we weren't able to serve everyone at the end of the day. And they didn't, there was no fights that broke out.
So you felt appreciated, it sounds like.
We were very appreciated.
And you felt like you made a real difference.
Yes.
Lori, you founded an organization in order to do this, right? And I think you've achieved some kind of a not-for-profit status. Tell us about that.
Right. So I've taken two groups to Ghana, and it's been very successful, and we've really been able to make an impact. So I felt like the next step was to form a nonprofit charity. So in May, we did get our 501c3 status, and so now we are...
Your organization is called?
It's called ASAP, which stands for Americans Serving Abroad Projects. So now we're able to get
to raise some funds,
yeah,
as well.
Tax-deductible donations, grants, things like that.
So why Ghana? I asked you this the last time, mm-hmm. but help our listeners understand, why did you choose Ghana as a country?
I did a lot of research before I started going on these trips, and I found an organization, Sem Fronteras, in Ghana that I partner with now. And I chose Ghana because it's a safe country. It's a peaceful country, yet they still have great need. There's a lot of poverty, and we're able to go make an impact, and Sem Fronteras makes sure we're safe. And
that the money that goes to them actually goes right to the people. In other words,
correct.
All of that effort is not kind of taken up with third kind of in the infrastructure, but rather really is delivered right to the people.
Correct, yes.
So you are now planning another trip.
Yes.
How has the Ebola crisis, which is not in Ghana, I understand, affected your planning and or your ability to recruit volunteers?
Well, we've had to, originally we were going to go back to Ghana in March, and we've had to kind of delay that to May because of the whole Ebola crisis,
outbreak.
I guess you could say. And the media hype over it, and people are afraid to go, I think, anywhere in Africa thinking that Ebola is everywhere. Ghana has actually had not one case of Ebola, even though it is in West Africa. West Africa is a large area. They've really done a good job, and they're making great progress in containing the Ebola in the countries it's in now. Sue, do you have anything to add about that?
I think, you know, when anytime you do a medical mission to any country, there's some inherent risks. I think Lori said this to me when I first decided to go. So, you know, honestly, when I went last year, I was concerned about malaria, which is, you know, ongoing there. I think that you just have to be educated and smart, just like here in our country. We know how to protect ourselves. I think some of those countries in Africa that have Ebola don't have the means to protect themselves. And I, you know, there
so
is
so public
no
health measures that you would mm-hmm. already know how as a medical professional, as well as all the vaccinations or immunizations or prophylactic medicines that you could take in
right.
the case of malaria. Right. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with Lori Ruprecht, a pediatric registered nurse, and Sue Converse, a pediatric family nurse, and nurse practitioner, and we're talking about an upcoming humanitarian mission to Ghana. Let's talk about this particular one, Lori. Do you have a different mission set, or do you just identify different villages each time you go? I mean, how do you plan these things? What's your kind of, you know, game plan?
Okay, so I work closely with, like I mentioned, I partner with Sem Fronteras, and I work closely with them in the planning stages. Really, it depends on what volunteers we have, what the project is going to look like. It will be some type of mobile medical clinic. That's what we focus on. So if we have physicians, we would do you know, maybe something a little different than if we didn't have physicians or nurse practitioners.
Are you hoping for physicians for this
round? I'm hoping to get a physician to go with us.
So to date, give me an overview of who your volunteers generally are.
Okay, so we've had nurses, nurse practitioners, physician's assistants, dental hygienist, social worker,
audiologist.
And were you able to do hearing screenings as a result?
We did a bit of it. We had a little problem with the equipment that we brought with us the electricity and all that kind of stuff. But we were able to do some of it.
So now you're looking for volunteers for this next mission. If someone were interested, much like Sue found out, how would they make contact with you? What do you recommend?
I think the easiest thing is to go right to our website. It's www.AmericansServingAbroad.com.
Is that just, you spell that all out, yep. AmericansServingAbroad.com.
Yes.
Okay.
You can go there to get more information on the trip, and there's a volunteer application on that site, and there's also, you can also contact me directly from that site. So that's the best way to do it.
Now, I asked you in the beginning, but I'm going to ask again. What prompted you ever to do this kind of work?
It's something that I wanted to do since I was a child. Honestly, I used to watch Sally Struthers on TV with Save the Children, and I just would say, I'm going to do that someday. And, you know, I mean, life gets in the way, and I got married, had children. But once they were older, I decided, I'm getting older, this is something I'm going to do. So, it's something I'm very passionate about now.
And Sue, in your case, did you ever think you would be going on medical missions to Africa?
I did not necessarily Africa, but my husband and I talked about it. But again, like Lori, I kind of thought that I would do it when all my children were grown. My children are teenagers and some in college now. And it fell into place. And it was a very good experience and I felt very safe. And extremely fulfilling. You know, it was renewing for me and my passion with healthcare.
That's very, very exciting. So what, you already kind of said this, but what, in Lori, in your mind, what's the most difficult thing that you, what's the most challenging part of any of these missions for you?
Probably choosing who we're going to serve and having to... not being able to serve everyone.
So to pick and choose in a way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And have you seen, what kind of outcomes have you seen as a result of your efforts?
We've picked up on a lot of things like high blood pressure, people didn't know they had. So when we do find things like that, we are able to tell them you need to go to the hospital or to the health clinic and get medication for this.
So there is follow-up, I guess, is
there
my
is.
Question.
There is, and a lot of the follow-up is done with my partner organization, Sem Fronteras, who, once we leave, follows up on the people that we say need follow-up on
if they need
further treatment.
So you feel there's some kind of a long-term impact on this kind of thing?
As well as immediate. There was a young boy we took care of last time that if we were not there with our medicine... He had pneumonia, and I don't know if he would have made it.
I would think the infant mortality or the child mortality must be pretty high.
The majority of the children that I did physicals on the last time were there had never seen a provider.
So are you bringing immunizations and all of that as well?
No, Ghana actually does have an immunization program, a pretty good program that they provide for their children. So we don't get involved.
Well, it sounds like an incredible experience, probably as incredible for you as for the people that you help. And
absolutely.
I think it's a very, very noble kind of thing that you're engaged in. And I'm so glad you've come and told us about your new mission coming up. Any listeners who are interested obviously can go to your website. That's AmericansServingAbroad.com and find out more about it and volunteer. And all the information will be on there, I guess, in terms of the costs and all of those things.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, once again, thanks so very much. My guests have been Lori Ruprecht, a pediatric registered nurse with the Center for Development, Behavior, and Genetics at Upstate Medical University, and Sue Converse, family nurse practitioner with St. Joseph's Hospital and a volunteer for the program. Once again, thanks so much.
Thank you.
I'm Linda Cohen. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. And now for some expert advice from the experts at Upstate. Dr. Stephen Ferrone, a distinguished professor of psychiatry and of neuroscience and physiology, tells parents what to do if they believe their child may have attention deficit hyperactivity disorder.
The most important thing is not to wait. Many parents are concerned about the child may have ADHD. They've read stuff in the internet or the news that make them worried about getting treatment, and they wait and they wait and they wait, and then many years later the child has serious problems because the child hasn't been treated. Most pediatricians are very well trained in diagnosing and treating ADHD, so tell your pediatrician you have these concerns, tell them why you have these concerns, and they'll do a careful evaluation and tell you whether your child has ADHD or doesn't. They might come back and they say, you know, your child just has normal childhood exuberance, and you're a little bit too worried, and I wouldn't worry about it. If that's the case, it's frequently the case, for example, with a young parent who is first child, they don't have a good comparison sample. But if you have three kids and you know your child's unusual, or your teacher's told you this is the worst kid in the class and this is an unusual child, then you need to either go back to the pediatrician or maybe see a psychologist or a psychiatrist to get a second opinion. Usually the pediatrician's right, but sometimes they do make mistakes. If they tell you the child has ADHD, don't delay treatment. Every year you delay treatment is a year that your child is exposed to many risks, the risks of having difficult friendships, not socializing properly, the risks of failing in school, not doing as well as they might. There's no reason to do that because all that happens is your child's self-esteem goes down and their problems get worse. Many parents delay treatment because there's lots and lots of misinformation on the internet. They'll tell you that ADHD medications are evil, they're dangerous, and so forth. Many ADHD medications have been used since the 1960s. They've been used safely with hundreds, thousands, millions of people. So don't be afraid of the medications. Many parents say, I want to try something else first before I go to medications. And that's your right as a parent to do that. But it's also your obligation as a parent to do the best for your child. So research those other options. And I'll tell you, as somebody who has researched those options, that there are very few that actually are known to work when they've been tried in many, many people, or there are many that have not been tried at all, and there's somebody just selling them because they can convince people to depart with some of their money for this service. Now, there's some that do work. For example, omega-3 fatty acids have been shown to be modestly helpful for children with ADHD. They're about half as effective as ADHD medications, but they can be useful. But again, you have to research that because all omega-3s aren't created equally and they're not regulated for the treatment of ADHD. You need one that's high in something called EPA as opposed to being lower in EPA. The other things you have to think about is to monitor how well your child is doing in treatment. What will happen typically is the pediatrician finds a good medication for your child. And this may involve trial and error. And don't be worried if the pediatrician tries one drug and it's not working well because of side effects or it's not reducing the symptoms and they move to another drug. It's perfectly normal. There's no simple way to say which ADHD drug of the ones that are available are going to be the best for your child. But after that period of time, hopefully your child is doing well and most will be doing well. You just need to monitor other problems the child might have because medications aren't always the complete answer. They may still have problems in school and require help there. You may need some help as a parent to learn how to parent your child better. There's something called behavioral family therapy that can help you. So keep thinking in the back of your mind, monitoring your child's progress, thinking of ways that you can help them. And don't worry. They'll do well if they're treated and you monitor them. Most people with ADHD are able to live productive and happy lives.
Next up, how a local healthcare institution is partnering with their neighbors for another medical mission, this time against breast cancer. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. This is Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. And it's time for your Healthy Monday Minute for the week of January 26th. Suds up for safety. Washing fruits and vegetables before eating them reduces the risk of foodborne illness. If fruits and veggies have a ridged or uneven skin, use a scrub brush to remove dirt from the grooves. Remember, even produce with inedible skin should be washed as a first step. This week, get into the habit of washing all produce thoroughly before serving. Be sure to start with clean hands and a sanitary workstation. Have a healthy Monday and a healthy week. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. It's well known that early detection for breast cancer can save lives, but not all women have equal access to mammography screening. Well, here with more on all of this is Linda Veit. She's the project director for Upstate Cancer Center and the director of the She Matters, a program of the Upstate Cancer Center. Also with her is Maxine Thompson, the assistant vice president for Upstate's Office for Diversity and Inclusion. Thank you both for coming in. So women don't have access to early detection of breast cancer, Linda, and specifically mammography screening. Tell us about that. Who are these women?
Well, lots of times lower-income women and most oftentimes women of color don't have the same access to mammography screening that white women have. And one of the goals of the Upstate Cancer Center is to reduce the burden of cancer in the communities we serve. And Upstate Cancer Center is committed to reducing the health disparities that we see specifically in breast cancer screening.
So tell us a little bit about that. There are disparities in terms of African American women, women of color, versus the white population. Can you say more about that?
Lots of times, black women don't have the access to screening and the access to quality screening that white women have. We tend to think that it may be an income status type socioeconomic level. There may be reasons for that, but they don't enjoy the same healthcare benefits that white women enjoy.
So what are the consequences of this, Maxine?
One of the consequences would be late stage identification of a cancer, for example, late treatment, no treatment. There's lots of different barriers to people of color in particular and people living in poverty, I think, to seeking health care on a timely basis. You know, as Linda mentioned, some of it is insurance, people that either lack insurance or are underinsured or can't get into a provider on a timely enough basis. Sometimes it's a lot of myths about, you know, what it means to have that kind of a diagnosis, a lot of fear that comes into play, and a lot of traditional ways that people have, that are cultural based about how you deal with those kinds of a diagnosis and treatment.
So in summary, I'm seeing that the disease is far more deadly than for women of color mm-hmm. than it is for the white population.
Absolutely. Part of the reason for that is because of the late identification, the late treatment-seeking behaviors.
Yeah, I saw a statistic that mm-hmm. 41% higher death rate
right.
in women of color.
Right,
than
African-American women have a 41% higher mortality than white women. As far as the five-year survival, that's even less in African-American women as opposed to white women. It's approximately 78% as opposed to the 95% rate that we see in white women.
So you've gotten a grant, and that's kind of why you're here to talk about this very exciting mm-hmm. program of the Cancer Center. Tell us about it.
So the Susan G. Komen Foundation of Central New York funded the She Matters program. It's a $50,000 grant with the goal to reduce the breast cancer disparity rate that is seen in our community. We decided to focus specifically on Pioneer Homes, but now that we're into the project, it's gone beyond Pioneer Homes.
So let's stop for a minute. Let's get a little background on this. Mm-hmm. Pioneer Homes, first mm-hmm. of all, Maxine, tell mm-hmm. us what it is.
Okay.
And what's the history for our listeners?
Okay, all right. So Pioneer Homes is a public housing complex that's part of the Syracuse Housing Authority. There are many public housing units within Syracuse Syracuse Housing Authority, but Pioneer Homes specifically happens to be Upstate's closest neighbor. We are, in fact, in their backyard. You know, sometimes we say they're in our backyard, but the truth is they were here first. Mm-hmm. Pioneer Homes is one of the earliest and the first public housing complexes in the state of New York. So we've long been concerned as healthcare providers and medical institutions about the existence of these health disparities that have, you know, beyond breast cancer, mm-hmm. there's all kinds of disparities in any number of disease entities for a variety of different reasons. And so several years ago, we decided as an organization, the leadership here wanted to make a very concrete and dedicated and concerted commitment to really looking at those issues and developing a better relationship and better delivery of care to our closest neighbors in Pioneer Homes. So we launched a community engagement strategy. We wanted to really immerse ourselves into what the residents were thinking, feeling, what were their needs from their perspective, not ours. I think that's been a problem all along with a lot of the research that's been done, not just in this area, but just historically, that people have the approach that, you know, we're the experts, we know. So we did the reverse. We went to the real experts, the true experts, which were the residents in the public housing unit. You know, what are your issues? What are your concerns? How can we, as Upstate Medical University, collaborate or partner with you to address your concerns? And so that was the beginning of the dialogue and the programming initiative that we started with Pioneer Homes back in 2011. So here we are, you know, almost 4 years into the project, and it's been very, very successful. I think that we have really engaged the Syracuse Housing Authority leadership. We've engaged the Pioneer Homes residents through the Pioneer Homes Tenant Association. We've identified some very, very critically important natural leaders within the residential population of Pioneer Homes who have really helped us meet their needs in a more concrete and sustainable way.
So a very key element of all of this are your resident health advocates.
Exactly.
Tell us.
Okay, so these are people that live in the Pioneer Homes. They are residents. They have the networks and the relationships with their neighbors. And they self-identified, really. They wanted to become more involved. And so we did some recruitment activity. We did some interviewing, and we selected a core of folks who wanted to do more to help their neighbors. So we trained them as resident health advocates, which is really a coming trend. You know, you're finding more and more other healthcare institutions are beginning to look at community health lay workers and how they can make a tremendous impact on reducing healthcare disparities.
So they serve, as educators and liaisons.
They are
from the community to the health institution.
Well, to their own neighbors. You know, we have put them through a training so that they are more aware themselves for their own needs, their own education, but also how they're able to communicate and impart this information to their neighbors.
So they're a big piece right now then of this She Matters program.
Absolutely.
Explain that. How does that work?
Well, as Maxine said, they had the background through the curriculum that they had when they went through the training to be resident health advocates with general health concerns and health issues. When we came in with the She Matters program, we narrowed it down specifically to breast cancer, and we taught the resident health advocates. We had our upstate professionals teach them on every aspect of breast cancer and outreach strategies in order to encourage and engage the women in their community to go and get screened.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with Linda Veach. She's the program director for Upstate's Cancer Center. And Maxine Thompson, she's the assistant vice president for Upstate's Office for Diversity and Inclusion. And we're talking about this She Matters program, which is a program to encourage breast cancer screening in low-income women. So what actually has taken place now, using your resident advocates and educating them, having them go out now into mm-hmm. their residences and communities, mm-hmm. are women coming forward? Are they being screened?
They are. It's really been an exceptional program. In the past 7 months that we've been operational, the RHAs have learned so much, and they have taught their neighbors so much.
RHA, Resident Health Advocates.
Okay. We do educational sessions with the RHAs. We taught them everything about breast cancer. They, in turn, hold educational sessions and teach their neighbors. They also do outreach. They go door to door. This is a grassroots type effort. They go door to door and encourage and educate women to get their mammograms. They even accompany the women that they sign up in our program, in our She Matters program, when they go and get their mammography. We make it a fun event. We go over to our 550 radiology location. We have what we call mammogram parties. The resident health advocates are right there educating, encouraging, and just supporting mm-hmm. the women that come.
So you've seen a good turnout, and what's the response been in general now to this specific program?
It's been excellent. We have over 200 women signed up in the She Matters program, meaning that they've either gotten education from us, from our resident health advocates, and out of the 200, approximately 60 have actually gone and gotten their mammograms.
That's wonderful.
It's been exceptional, really, because our goal for the purposes of the grant were to reach, I think, 149 women, and mm-hmm. we have only been doing this for a few months, and I think we are well on our way to exceeding those goals.
That's
been very exciting
for
us.
That is very exciting. But you also, I'm going to take you back to the first thing mm-hmm. you started to say, which was you have started out with Pioneer Homes as your target,
right.
but you're now looking to expand.
Right.
So explain that.
Well, you know, as Maxine pointed out, there's 149 women who we've identified who are 40 years of age and older, and that's actually the standard that we're using for mammography screening, the annual screening for those women who are 40 and over. But it's gone beyond that. You know, our resident health advocates have such a strong ties and a wide network in the community. They're going out and they're reaching, whether it's family, friends, outside of Pioneer Homes. Some are in low-income areas, some aren't. But you know what? It's great. They come. They are part of the She Matters program.
They're spreading the word.
Exactly. It's mm-hmm. become more than just Pioneer Homes. The She Matters program has become a movement.
So now, is it free to the participants? Explain how that works.
It is. So, I mean, you know, breast cancer screening is covered if you have Medicare or Medicaid. And if the person is either underinsured or has no insurance, then we work with the county. The Onondaga County has a cancer services program partnership, and we work very closely with them, and we refer people to their program, and they, in turn, pay for the screening that is done still at our 550 Harrison location at Upstate. So they enjoy all the same benefits that everyone else in the She Matters program gets.
So if right now there are people listening who might be interested in participating in this program, what are the criteria? Who are you looking for out
there?
Well,
our criteria to be in the She Matters program, obviously we want women who are 40 and over to come and get educated and get their mammograms, but we also have a huge cohort of women who are under the age of 40 who we just want to educate. We just want to give them breast cancer education for themselves, for their friends, and for their family. So it's all women.
So anyone who's interested, we're going to have a number on our website. Mm-hmm. That's HealthLinkOnAir, that's all one word, .org, and they can make contact with your program, find out more about it. I'm curious about one other thing. As we started this conversation, you were explaining, Maxine, that this was part of a larger movement mm-hmm. to talk about disparity mm-hmm. in terms of all kinds of health concerns.
Right.
Is there some kind of a effect that the She Matters program is having in terms of widening that reach or opening the doors?
Absolutely. I think through the outreach efforts of the RHAs, you know, they become viewed as resources around not only breast care issues, but of wide variety. And we hope to expand their education going forward and, in fact, expand the whole core of resident health advocates that we have available to us that will go through a curriculum training similar to what this group has done and be able to focus on other areas of disparities such as smoking, you know, lung cancer,
obesity.
There's mm-hmm. a wide variety of things, diabetes. There's any number of things where we know that there has been historically disparities in outcomes that we're hopefully going to be able to eventually address. So we're starting small with Pioneer Homes and around breast cancer screening. But the goal is that we will expand this program beyond Pioneer Homes and beyond other disease entities.
Well, I want to congratulate you both. It's really an outstanding program. And best of luck with this project. And, you know, any new initiatives you want to come back and tell us about, we'd be very interested in hearing. My guests have been Linda Veach. She's project director for the Upstate Cancer Center and the director of the She Matters program, a program of the Cancer Center. Also, Maxine Thompson, assistant vice president for Upstate's Office of Diversity and Inclusion. Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. And now, Deirdre Nealon, editor of Upstate Medical University's literary and visual arts journal, The Healing Muse, with this week's selection.
Thank you, Linda. Poet and professor Catherine Haug Mann from Ithaca, New York, takes the story of the princess Sleeping Beauty and puts a different spin, pun intended, on it in her lovely sonnet, Beauty. To stay in bed and dream 100 years, I understand the need for such deep peace, the soul's full sojourn in a place where tears recede and memory finds sweet release. To raise a thorny hedge along the wall of self and turn away from the world, not miss supposed splendors, but rejoice in all heart solitude beyond a prince's kiss. Most weavers' threads praise union, tapestry of love as otherness, a castle room where bright-eyed courtiers dance and laugh. To be aloof is to be lost upon the loom. I spin another story, life alone, where roses overgrow the golden throne.
Thank you for joining us for Upstate's HealthLink on Air, brought to you each week by Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York. Join us again next week when we explore a little-known disease called sarcoidosis and what can be done about it, plus how to prevent kidney stones, and the recurring problem of sports-related concussions and how to avoid them. If you'd like to listen again to tonight's show, you can find a podcast of it on our website. That's HealthLinkOnAir, that's all one word, .org. And to keep up with all the goings-on at Upstate, you can find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or check out the What's Up at Upstate blog at upstate.edu/whatsup. HealthLink on Air is directed by Amber Smith and Jennifer Congel and produced by Steve Marks, with sound engineers John Miller and Gerard Roy. I'm Linda Cohen. Thanks for listening.